Good morning, everyone. My name is Daniel, for those of you who doesn't know me. I've been here in Alma for 3 years, I think, now. And I do apologize if I start coughing all through the sermon, but I won't stop to say sorry, because we could stay here forever then. I wonder how many of you have watched the film The Passion of the Christ? Many of you. I think it's a brilliant film. It's got a couple of things that we may not agree with. It might be a bit bloody as well. But all in all, I think it's a brilliant film. And anyway, is it really bloody? Why, yes. But no. Personally, I think that this film is made us, Christians, a big favor. We've heard the gospel stories or read them far too often. We are too used to them so much that we've become immune to their content, to their power. We read the stories and they don't say much to us. We already know what they are about, so we don't really pay attention to them anymore. But if we saw today on the news someone being flogged, beaten on the screen, we would scream or faint. We would be angry that something like that happens today. Yet we read it in the Gospels. And, it doesn't affect us in the same way. I think the film, whether we like it or not, brings us today all the harshness, all the brutality of that crucial moment in history. It conveys the agonizing feelings very well. It takes us a step closer to the real Jesus, the one suffering there, the one who wanted to avoid what he came to do, but the one who would do it anyway because he chose so. But the film doesn't focus only on the pain and the gory bits and the blood and everything. It shows something else that we will see later. Something that at first sight may not appear to be in the text, but it is there. And a careful reader would soon notice that. When we read this passage, we can't avoid thinking of how much Jesus suffered for us. All the things he had to endure to obtain salvation for us, all the things he had to suffer just for love. Here we see Jesus weak, powerless, suffering, bleeding and dying. Death on a cross was an excruciating experience, something very painful indeed. Yet, let me tell you this, as hard as it was, dying on a cross, this might have been the least of the worries for Jesus at that time. Because this passage in Matthew, despite of what it seems, is not about how Jesus heroically stays there suffering, doing nothing, and how he endures tortures and beatings and everything. It's not about Jesus being weak and feeble and fragile, despite appearances. This is about a strong, a fighting Jesus, a Jesus that fights, resists, and wins. I know the story doesn't look like that yet, but if we follow Matthew through all the Gospel, when we reach this point, we will see that Matthew wants to show us something different with this scene. Now let me go to another film, the story of Beowulf, or something like that. I can't pronounce the name. It's just been released this weekend, and they've made, all the computer games and everything. And the mobile version of the game uses this sentence to promote the game. Resist temptation and confront absolute evil. Resist temptation and confront absolute evil. That is precisely what it's all about here. That is precisely what Jesus is doing in that text that we've just read. He is facing evil. He's fighting temptation. He's resisting in a very difficult time. And that is for him harder than the nails and the whipping and the flogging. We all know the story, and we know, well, to put it in a simplistic way, that at the end Jesus wins, he raised from the dead and everything. But here, when we read this passage, Jesus has been mocked, Jesus has been flogged, Jesus has been killed, and this fighting attitude doesn't really seem to be there. Yet, that's what Matthew wants to show us here, a resistant Jesus, someone fighting. So let's go to the Gospel and see how we can read this text from a more adequate perspective. Now, to see why instead of seeing a defeat Jesus, we can see someone fighting there, we need to understand a few things. First, we need to know how to read a Gospel, and then we need to know how to read this particular Gospel. I know it may sound a bit silly, but well, reading a Gospel should be something very straightforward, isn't it? You just start reading and then get to the end, that's it. But then what do you do with the content of what you've been reading? How do you interpret that? First thing we need to know is that Gospels are biographies. But that's a tricky bit, because they are not like modern biographies, not like the ones we read about David Beckham or, I don't know, Tony Blair. They are a different kind of biographies. They are Greco-Roman biographies. And those biographies were written on the centuries just before and after Jesus' time. And they were written to promote a character, the Caesar, some religious leader or something like that. And they were also written for the followers of that person to see an example to follow. So we can say that if the Gospels want to promote Jesus, they would never write anything that contradicts this principle of promoting. Therefore, this passage shouldn't be interpreted as something shameful, even if dying on a cross was not the most popular thing to do at that time. On the other hand, if it's supposed to be a guide for us, then there is something we can learn from it. The temptation here is to think that, well, we can't forgive sins, and we definitely won't save the world, so we can just sit and look at how good Jesus was dying for us, and that's it. But even if it's true that we can't exactly do what he did, there is still something we can learn and live in our lives. Lastly, in antiquity, the way a person died was the most crucial time of his life, because there, the person would show his true colors, his real character, or deliver a master plan for when he's gone, or maybe both, or something very important. So to truly know Jesus, the Passion narratives, are a very important place to start. Looking at the way Jesus faces his death can tell us a lot about his person and his mission. So Gospels promote a person, and that person is set as an example to us, and especially we can learn from Jesus from the way he faces his death. This is how we read the Gospel, but what about reading Matthew? Someone said that the Gospel of Matthew was written to be read all in one go, starting from the first verse, ending at the last without stop. If you wonder why, well, that's because Matthew, it's a very skillful writer, and he is a Jew. And you may think, why, and what's that supposed to mean? Well, I don't know if you remember, a few weeks ago, someone was talking about formal education for Jewish boys at Jesus' time. They had to learn the first five books of the Bible. they had to memorize them. And that's a lot to memorize. And if they were good at that, then they had to learn the following with the historical books. And if they were good, the rest. And, well, I don't want to undervalue that. That's a lot to learn, even if you use tricks or anything. And I don't think I could do it. But Jewish writers developed a whole system of repetitions, structures, patterns that one could use when they were writing. So when you were memorizing, you could always point back to something that can bring the whole text back, but also that can help you interpret and understand that part in the light of the thing is pointing back. So when we go to Matthew and we find these patterns, repetitions, then we start to understand how the gospel works. And any normal Jew would recognize all these patterns, all these things, as soon as they would see it in the text. So reading Matthew in one go should help us keep these words, these structures fresh in our minds, so when we see them, we recognize them, and we can quickly go back and see, oh, Matthew wants us to read this thing with this in mind. In Jewish writings, repetitions and these kind of things are never accidental. They are there for a purpose. And with that in mind, we can now go to the passage we just read and see how Jesus is our example for resisting temptation. The first thing we find in the verses that were read this morning is the Roman soldiers mocking Jesus. They would probably do that with every person going to death. But in this case, they are having special fun because this person is said to be the king of the Jews. That's, I mean, well, we can play something different today now. And in placing this word here, "Hail, King of the Jews," Matthew is already pointing somewhere else. The kingdom of God and the kingdom of heaven is probably the most prominent topic in Matthew's gospel. If we go right at the beginning, we find a genealogy where we can trace Jesus' family back to King David. And then we find the wise men coming to adore Jesus, the newborn king. And then we find John the Baptist, and then Jesus proclaiming that the kingdom of heaven is at hand. So by bringing up this king idea, Matthew, which is now narrating the end of Jesus' ministry, is pointing back to the beginning of Jesus' ministry, where he starts. And the kingdom of God there is said to be at hand. And now, in his death sentence, Jesus is officially proclaimed the King of the Jews. However, Jesus appears now in a very deplorable condition, not very much as a king. But that too points us to that same point at the beginning of Jesus' ministry. There, right between John the Baptist's proclamation and Jesus' proclamation of the kingdom, Matthew inserts two events: the baptism and the temptations. And there, just after being baptized, Jesus spends 40 days fasting. And he feels, I expect, very weak. And just at this very moment, when he's most weak, the devil comes and starts tempting him. And the first thing he tries to do is tempting Jesus with something that he probably wants more than anything at that time, food. But it's not just a temptation about food. It's about taking plan B. It's about not following God's plans, but taking the easy way. The devil knows that Jesus may not give up so easily, so he implies that if he doesn't do it that way, he can really be the Son of God. But the readers know that it is precisely in not following the devil's suggestion that he is proving to be the Son of God. Matthew is then pointing back to that scene that right at the beginning of Jesus' ministry, and wants us to bring up here that scene into the crucifixion at the end of his ministry. Here is where I think the film, the Passion of the Christ, gets it right. All throughout the film, we can see that sinister character appearing every now and then, which is not in the text, but I think it's implied by the text, the devil coming and tempting Jesus. And he's always remembering Jesus that there could be another way if he wanted, that suffering and dying can be avoided by obeying him rather than the Father. That is why Matthew wants us to bring the temptations here, because Jesus, in this precise moment, more than ever, is being tempted with throwing in the towel. Darkness is coming over Jesus, and the idea of escaping it, it's more and more tempting now. Besides, he's feeling very weak. He's been beaten and flogged, and his strength to resist is fading. The devil always tries Jesus in his weakness to get his way. And the devil knows that being hungry or after being beaten, Jesus is more vulnerable, and giving up might be an easy option. But it is right here where Jesus shows his amazing determination to keep obedient to the Father's will. He knows his priorities, and despite the pain and agony he's capable of resist, he is through a very hard moment, and he is resisting. And so he sets an example for us on how to resist temptation. But there is more. On the second part of the text that we read earlier, we find Jesus now already on the cross, hanging there. And the Jews are the ones mocking Jesus this time. He is still weak and fragile, because resisting temptation before didn't make it disappear. But now, the Jesus, like the devil in the temptations, try a different strategy. Matthew again, in an even more striking way, points us back to the temptations when he recalls that the Jewish leaders, using exactly the same words as in Matthew 4, if you are the Son of God. They want Jesus to understand that someone who can save himself can save others, and so can be the Son of God. What they don't understand is that it is precisely by not saving himself that he is able to save others. These temptations must have been especially painful. First, because Jesus has the power to actually do what he's asked for. He could come down from the cross and save himself. Actually, the Jews expected that the Messiah made a big display of power when he comes. But Jesus, all along the Gospel, has been showing that in his kingdom, power is not the way. It's love and care for each other. So showing his power, saving himself, could, yes, save his life, but it would make his kingdom like any other kingdom, where the strong and the powerful oppress the poor and the weak. And he would make his own teachings void, not to say that then the whole salvation plan would be ruined. On the other hand, they're questioning Jesus' relationship to the Father. Jesus knows he is the Son of God. Jesus knows the Father loves him. But for the Jews, this doesn't make any sense. How can the Father, if he loves him, let him die if he is the Son of God? For them, the answer is clear. He is not the Son of God. And in verse 43, we can see that very clear. I don't know how you get that in your Bibles translated, but we can say something like, let God rescue him if he delights in him, or if he wants him. And that is, again, pointing back to that sin, the baptism temptation sin. There, Jesus, after being baptized, can hear the voice of the Father saying, he is my beloved Son, in him I am well pleased. Jesus knows he is loved by the Father, but then the Jews are trying to question that. And I guess that in that very moment, things like that may have just crossed Jesus' mind, maybe. And I think, again, that's a very special moment in the movie. I'm sure you remember the scene where Jesus is being flogged, because it's difficult to forget. He is there, the Roman soldiers are having fun, he is bleeding on the floor, and just for a couple of seconds, again, that sinister character, the devil, crosses the screen, dressed in black, and carrying or hugging a baby. And that's what he's saying. Look, I can take care of my son better than your father. And he's being tempted. Even the devil seems to care for his children, but the Father is leaving Jesus there to his devices. And I think this temptation is especially painful if you bear in mind that Jesus knows that in a few moments he's going to be abandoned by the Father, because the Father can't bear the sight of all the sin Jesus is going to carry. And so Jesus will have to cry, my God, why have you forsaken me? Yet Jesus is on a mission, and even if all the temptations seem more and more appealing every second, he won't give up. He knows that the easy way doesn't end where he wants it to end. If only the easy way would accomplish the same, he then would try it. But he knows that the easy way won't accomplish anything good. Even when all he wants to do is to get down and say, look, I can't do it, now just leave me alone, I'm going back to the cross, which many of us would like to do. But then he knows if he does that, they win. And instead that, he resists and he wins. This time, despite the bullying and emotional blackmail in the temptations, Jesus is able to resist as well. He knows that precisely because he wants to save others, and because the Father do care, he has to remain on the cross until everything is accomplished. And so he does. And therefore in Jesus we see again a complete example of resisting temptation, whatever the situation. And what about us? It would be very easy to say just that, well, if you ever are asked if you are a Christian or not, just say yes, because you are a Christian. Don't hide it. But that's very easy. I mean, we all know we should do that. And normally, we can see that coming if we start in a new job, if we start at university, if we start anywhere new. People will ask things. And you know you have to say something, and you have the option to choose right or wrong. But it's when temptation is more subtle, when you don't see it coming, that it's more worrying. It is when it's not so clear that it really is a temptation. Jesus was tempted to use his power to avoid suffering, and probably it is when we are tempted by power that we should be more vigilant. Sorry. Things like trying to keep appearances in charge rather than showing who or how we really are, even if that means losing the good reputation we may have? Or what about trying to keep close to some people in charge so others will see that I am important, that, you know, the leaders know me? Or what about trying to keep up, trying to do lots of things in charge, especially things in front of others, like in here or in other activities, so people see how good I am? Or using very nice and spiritual language so people will think that I read the Bible every day, even if it's not true? What about keeping in our safe alma mate's bubble and don't care much about if someone new comes, or if someone is in need, or if someone is alone? We just prefer to keep in our group. Others might be losing the benefit of our gift, but then I'm safe, I'm not suffering. What about the church as a whole? Now it's an important time for the church. We are in a transition period. We are defining our future, what we want to do, what we want to achieve, looking for people to take these plans forward. And I think it's a good time to plan carefully, to think what we want for Alma, and I'm sure they've been doing that already, but maybe to rethink things would be good. What do we want for Alma? Are we seeking numbers and recognition? Is Alma looking to be known to all Christian entities in Bristol and England? Or do we prefer to be known by the people in Clifton, in our neighborhoods? Are we trying to be cool so people feel they want to come? Or are we trying to take care of the ones here first so they feel they can bring others knowing they will be cared for? What do we want for Alma? Is it quality versus quantity? Do we want to stick, like Jesus, to the Father's will? Or do we want to be popular and stick to the world's will? I tried to think of as many things as I could, not pointing to anyone, but trying to make everyone reflect with the hope that we, that I, can help Alma be a better church. We are humans, seeking power and recognition, or avoiding suffering, are part of us. We will do it, we will fail. But it's a part of us that we should leave on the cross, and a part that we can help each other leave behind. And I hope we can do it. Thank you.